Hello, welcome to Culture Power Politics. I'm Jeremy Gilbert. I'm here, as so often, with Alan Finneyson.
So, is this an emergency podcast or just a podcast? I think it's always an emergency when I'm talking to you.
The emergency is ongoing.
Yes.
Emergency is non-stop. But as I'm always pointing out, the very first emergency podcast we did was because Keir Starmer had published a mediocre pamphlet with the Fabian Society. So pretty much anything can count as an emergency by those standards. And yes, today we are going to be talking about the Gorton and Denton by-election that took place last Thursday. The result was last Friday. This is Monday, 2nd of March, 2026. And a by-election for people outside the UK is what is called in other places a special election. That's when a sitting member of parliament, or it can be some other legislative body, but in this case it's parliament, has stepped down for whatever reason or died or whatever. And so a special election has to be called. In this case, as listeners to the podcast, you will have heard us cover when this happened. The favourite amongst voters in the Manchester seat of Gorton and Denton was the Manchester Mayor, Andy Burnham, but he was prevented from becoming an official Labour candidate because it was widely assumed that if he did, he would quickly challenge Keir Starmer for the leadership of the party and win and thus become Prime Minister. And the National Executive Committee of Labour didn't want that to happen. So instead, this is really interesting because as soon as that happened, there was considerable speculation that both the Reform Party on the right and the Green Party on the left would now pose a serious challenge. And I wish I'd been more publicly certain in my predictions, actually. I was being very cautious, as most people were. Alan and I are on a WhatsApp group where I offered to bet anybody £100 that the Greens would win as soon as Burnham was blocked, before the Greens even announced their candidate.
Yeah, not a bet I would take, because I think it was definitely...
Yeah, it wasn't like... they were the bookies' favourite to begin with. So, and what's happened, as anybody listening will probably be aware, unless they're listening to this as an archive recording in the distant future, which is quite possible, Hannah Spencer there? Hannah Spencer, the Green candidate, won by a more comfortable margin than anybody was expecting. This seems like a really significant electoral outcome. This is the first time the Greens have won a by-election. It's the first time they've won a seat, really, when the situation is not as it was with the four parliamentary seats they won in 2024 general election, one where they've been building up locally over years and years, really, to try to take the seat. That isn't the situation in this area, although the Greens have an active membership in the Manchester area. And it's the first by-election that's been fought since Zach Polanski became leader of the party in September, which has seen a massive increase in their poll rating and a massive influx of members as they've embraced an unambiguously left populist program and rhetoric. So overall, it's really dramatic. So what else can we say by way of introduction to this issue, Alan?
Well, I suppose I'm going to be a boring one and say it is dramatic for all the reasons that you've given. And it is significant in that it would look like voters were deciding that the Greens were the party to vote for to beat Reform. So the left bloc, which was clearly split, Labour came third, but they did get a lot of votes. The left bloc largely decided to vote Green in order to beat Reform. And that echoes what happened in Wales in one of the seats for the Senate there, where voters moved to Plaid Cymru and Labour dropped out to very low because they figured that was the party to vote Reform. So that's significant. The reason I say I don't want to pour cold water on it, but one has to also factor in that by-elections are not a good basis for predicting national political outcomes. There are unusual situations, lots of factors, people testing out candidates they might not vote for in general elections or under the pressure spotlight of the by-election. So dramatic things can happen in by-elections, but then don't translate into national changes, which is not, I'm not trying to take all the fun out of it that people have got who found it a kind of, you know, an interesting and interestingly upsetting the normal routine of politics vote. But I think we want to be, it's hard to be sure exactly what it will lead to. But that's partly why I kind of think we should talk about it in terms of the what's already emerging, as it were, the kind of contestation over the meaning of Gorton and Denton. Because part of what will matter about it is not just how my political science colleagues will read it as a way of predicting things that will happen in the future. It's how it's set already begun to shift the way people are disputing and debating politics and what's going on and positioning themselves in relation to it. So I think there's something for us to think about in terms of both what the result tells us about where people are at now, but how the way it's being construed and represented and argued over, the rhetoric around it, is beginning to shift and realign some of the zones of conflict in British politics. That's what I think, anyway.
Yes, I think you're right. All that is true. I mean, it's been seen as significant because it is seen as sort of proof of concept.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Greens can position themselves on the basis of a left agenda as the main challenger to the insurgent populist right, and can really inspire voters in that way. That is significant. But I think it is true. One has to be on. I mean, look, I was really excited. I was delighted by the result. Because even though I am formerly a member of the Labour Party, you know, I think there's no question for the left, it's a fantastic result. And I think the reason I immediately predicted the Greens, I mean, I thought the Greens would walk it initially, actually, because the thing I kept saying to people, including saying to my one Tory friend in the world who's based around Manchester, I was saying, look, there are going to be loads of just Labour Party people, either some still active members or very recent members, knocking on doors, saying to people, look, I'm saying to all these historically loyal Labour voters, look, I'm Labour like you, but we've got to vote Green this time because we can't take this. The blocking of Burnham is just unacceptable. And I'm sure, I haven't had anyone anecdotally confirm that was happening, but I'm sure it was. And I'm sure, and I know, you know, I grew up in the Northwest. That sort of thing resonates with people because it sounds real and it's sincere and it's motivated by a kind of righteous anger. So I wasn't at all surprised by the result, but I also think, yeah, the implications are significant because, I mean, the polling has shown for many years that the Greens, there were a significant proportion of the electorate saw the Greens as actually representing their ideology and their worldview better than any other party, but they thought that a vote for the Greens would almost always be a wasted vote, except in some proportional elections. And having got over that threshold is really significant. But the reason we should be a bit cautious is because there is precedent for this in the history of British politics. There's precedence for this in my nan's lifetimes, which is the Social Democratic Party, the SDP. Won some significant by-elections, performed very well in some others in the period between its formation in 82 and the general election in 83, where they didn't hold all of the seats and they didn't make the kind of breakthrough they thought they were going to make. But they did end up having a massively disruptive effect on the general electoral system. But the story of the SDP is in some ways much more dramatic than the story of the Greens. So the story of the SDP sort of, announced themselves as a breakaway from the Labour Party. And then within about 18 months, they were polling over 50% in some opinion polls. They were just seen by a huge section of the public for a really brief period as the answer to all their problems. And the answer to the polarising crisis of that early Thatcherism. But they ended up, it ended up being a failed project. They effectively ended up having to allow themselves to be sort of reabsorbed into a liberal party, which I would say had been kind of recovering its historic position for about a decade before that anyway. So So it is perfectly possible to imagine a scenario in which, you know, Labour ends up shifting to the left in response to this, and the green surge is just a kind of historical blip. There are lots of reasons to think that isn't what's happening, which we can get into. But I think you're completely right, Alan. I mean, the question is to some extent, all of this is going to be determined by how people interpret all this, and like if this is interpreted as a sign on the to be read by the sort of the mainstream of the Labour Party, the parliamentary Labour Party, the Labour leadership, the Labour bureaucracy, that they must very dramatically change course, then that is what I think would happen. I think if they were just to say, oh my God, we made a terrible mistake, let's get Andy Burnham a seat by September, let him become leader, let him become prime minister, and then let's adopt a formal left-wing program. I think indeed the green surge would probably go down below 10%, and it would end up having been something of a blip. But
yeah,
that all that is incredibly unlikely to happen.
Doesn't look likely to happen. Yeah. So should we get into it a bit? Let's do our kind of cultural analysis. Yeah. So can I southern splain Manchester to you then?
Yes.
Well, because it strikes me that part of what's going on, it must be at some level for Labour people disturbing that Manchester voted in this way. You know, I guess everyone in the UK knows this, maybe not people listening internationally, but it seems to me Manchester is one of the cities that occupies a place in the kind of the national imagination. Not every city does. London, Liverpool, Manchester, these kind of places do. Because this is... is it arguable the kind of the first city of modern industrialization? That's Manchester, with all the fallout from that. It's the home of it, isn't it? Yeah, it's the birthplace of a form of liberalism, Manchester liberalism, as well as the home of Chartism, demands for equal rights, civil rights of a very important historical. Engels lived there, writing The Condition of the Working Class in England. The Peterloo Massacre in 1819, the attempt to put down people's demand for rights, all these things happen in Manchester, and they are to some degree memorialised. I mean, the English especially are very bad at remembering any of their history, but they're, you know, these things have their place certainly in the left and Labour tradition. So, you know, this is an important kind of redoubt, as it were, once upon a time, of Labour organising and later of the Labour Party and of trade unionism. But also an important post-war city that tells us something about the way things have changed and developed, because in the post-Fordist era, you know, Manchester suffers very badly from deindustrialization that transforms its visual appearance as well as its economic and political scene, part of which manifests itself very importantly in a shift towards cultural expression. And the importance of Manchester as a scene for punk music in the 70s as an absolutely foundational site for the emergence of new forms of dance music in the 80s. See, now I'm music-splaining to Jeremy Gilliam.
Yeah, you're right. No, you're totally right. But
what strikes me, and part of what I want to hear from you about, though, is that dimension of Manchester that makes, you know, to everyone our age, Manchester is, you know, post-punk, it's Madchester, it's a central place of Britpop, etc., all those kinds of things. But it's also economically partly tried to address its deindustrialization through that cultural scene, through a heavy emphasis on the nighttime economy. I don't know when you were last in Manchester, but it's just
a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and it's just completely full of things going on. Bars, cafes, outdoors, it's stuff. It was kind of quite pioneering in terms of the Canal Street, you know.
A lot of that revolves around the university type.
Yes. Yeah. So it's also, yeah, it's hugely funded by, I mean, what is the number of students there? When you're between Manchester University and Manchester Met, that's, what is that? It feels like there's nothing but students.
It's one of
40,000, 50,000 in.
Yeah. It's one of the biggest student populations in Europe, concentrated into a relatively small area.
Yeah. Yeah, and completely shapes that scene. But the flip side of that, of course, is also what Isaac Rose, in quite an important book, calls the Rentier City. It's also a city that's kind of like rebuilt tower blocks, businesses, you know, finance, capital, etc. So the kind of the Burnham miracle is partly dependent on foreign investment by different kinds of equity funds. I mean, it's also dependent, importantly, on an extremely well-structured transport network, which has hugely facilitated agglomeration effects. But I suppose it feels to me significant both for us as analysts, but also culturally, that Manchester is this city that is a kind of, on the one hand, epitome of industrialization and at the front line of deindustrialization, and in this sharp contradictory situation where the cultural nighttime student debt driven economy is really important to it, as well as finance capital that is building up all these buildings. And that's creating all sorts of contradictions in terms of material life, ideological orientation, voting behavior, that I think are part of what is playing out in the background of the whole. Even though Gordon Denton isn't exactly in that middle, it intersects with that and really embodies those tensions. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I couldn't put it any better, really. I mean, Manchester is a kind of symbol of modernity itself, in a way, from the 19th century onwards. It's seen as the urban home of the Industrial Revolution. It's not really the real home of the Industrial Revolution, is the mill towns out in Lancashire, but it becomes the hub around which all those are organised, actually. It becomes the kind of central trading hub, which is benefiting from the growth of the mill towns. And just as you say, it becomes a symbol of deindustrialization. I mean, the sort of, you know, the music of Joy Division is kind of heard as the soundtrack to deindustrialization by a lot of people in Britain. And then it's also a kind of symbol. It's the one place in Britain where a certain kind of, you know, creative industries led, you know, regenerate, like post-Fordist or even like proto-platform capitalist regeneration policy is seen as being relatively successful. Maybe Glasgow as well. But it's still, you know, there are still significant levels of poverty. And as you say, on the back of all that, Andy Burnham has made his career being like the most left-wing sort of local government leader in England of the kind of current generation, which isn't saying much by historic standards, but he hasn't been given a lot of scope anymore than any of his contemporaries have. So, it has retained this identity. It's retained this identity as a kind of as a progressive place, basically, as a quite self-conscious identity. So all that is true, and I think it is really significant. And there was something. I mean, some people I know up there thought that people were being over-optimistic about a green victory because they thought that Manchester Labour, led by Andy Burnham, had a sufficiently kind of autonomous identity from the National Party and the national polity that they would be able to carry it. But in the end, that isn't what happened. So yeah, it is significant, and it certainly should be sort of traumatizing for Labour. But I think it's going to make people around the country feel like green victories in all kinds of places seem less plausible and less implausible than they were. I mean, one can qualify all this in all kinds of ways. You know, you can point out Gorton and Denton is his mixed constituency. Gorton is a Manchester suburb with a lot of students and a lot of Asian people. And Denton is more of an old traditional mill town where reform were hoping they would get enough support there that they'd be able to overwhelm the vote for the left in out of Gorton. And you can make all kinds of, you know, you can engage in all kinds of special pleading as to why it's not that significant. And, you know, Manchester's always been more left wing than the Midlands, or, for example, all that is true. But ultimately, you can't really get away from the fact that this is a symbolically significant place. And you know, if people don't know the geography of Britain that well, I mean, Manchester is right in the middle, if you include Scotland. It's talked about as being in the north, it's in the north of England. But if you include Scotland, it's actually right in the middle of the country, and it does have this kind of centrality to it, which I think makes it really symbolic. So, yeah, I do think it is really significant.
So what can we talk a bit more about the constituency? Because a lot of reporting tried to paint the constituency as this, well, on one hand, this very weird kind of, it is a sort of artificially generated community out of kind of the needs of trying to create constituencies of roughly equal sizes. So as you say, these two distinct bits. And then some tried to present it as a sort of, is this a kind of marker of the divisions of Britishness or something? But I think, which is, might be true, but it struck me as kind of interesting to think about it in terms of how, well, having sort of talked about how what Manchester means for Labour, one sort of way of reading the Manchester Gorton result would be to say, this is some kind of turn of a twist of the dialectic from New Labour, right? In that things New Labour sets in place now come back to bite it. And that's partly why I mentioned the cultural nighttime economy, right? Because part of New Labour was, let's promote the cultural economy as the answer to deindustrialization that will be free and creative and innovative, which, you know, has employed people, but employs people in occupations that are not going to be super well paid, are precarious, puts them at the mercy of landlords in a city with high rents. I mean, it's got to be no coincidence that in her speech after winning the Green candidate, she says, right at the start of it, she says she's looking forward to representing people, can't wait to get started and work to influence people that makes life better for people, can't work to influence policy that makes life better for people like us, to bring down the cost of living, introduce rent controls, and get the litter and fly tipping off our streets. I mean, put that range of issues there, right? Cost of living, rent controls, quality of the streets, yeah? No wonder she won, right? If that were the issues. Yeah. But what gets me is that rent controls thing is partly speaking to a generation that is living precariously in creative type labour. But also, as you said, there's a lot of students in this, massively indebted students.
Yeah.
Which are Labour's creation. Right?
Yes, that's all true, yeah.
Who either are about to graduate or have graduated, are worrying about their employment, and again, at the mercy of kind of landlords in this city with a particular kind of property market that's going on, yeah? So here's this kind of... this is sort of payback, as it were. I mean, that's before we even mention the number of voters who might have been influenced by the effects of Labour's Middle East policy, which takes shape in the New Labour years, and continues to be shaped by the legacy of that in the present day. So all these things that the Blairite years do that they seem to forget have longer term effects, particularly as new generations grow up. And I think Labour doesn't understand that for many people of maybe sort of 35, Labour is the war party. It's the start wars party,
yeah, yeah.
And the charge you for going to, you know, not just, I know that the Liberals and Tories get a lot of stick for that quite rightly, but Labour is the party that introduced that student debt. So now you've got a situation the point I'm trying to get to is because if Manchester has some kind of place in the Labour and national imagination for the working class, organised working class, and the history of industrialisation, it's a big problem for those people. They then don't understand that actually some of the people who are precarious and trapped in low employment are actually going to be graduates.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
In debt.
For sure.
In the creative economy. Because I think part of the key to understanding British politics is the ways in which people fantasize various ideas of the working class that are uninformed by any sociological or socioeconomic analysis. Yeah. But don't understand. And therefore, they think that these people are, you know, the stupid graduates that get in, you know, blah blah blah, you know, and since that's a key part of who voted for, you know, the Greens in Manchester, which tells us that part of what is going on here is also a generational dispute, as it were. I think that's part of the source of the vote, isn't it? It's younger people who have no reason to be loyal to Labour, don't see Labour as anything other than the war party, who are experiencing the sharp end of low pay, precarious employment and difficult property market in the context of a rising cost of living. They didn't vote for the government. Surprise. They voted for the woman who said that she was going to attack the rent landlords and make the streets nicer.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that's exactly
Go right. figure.
I mean, that is exactly right. I mean, Manchester is a sort of embodiment of the knowledge economy. The contemporary Manchester is an embodiment of the idea of the knowledge economy. I mean, it's notable that it's not just got two universities. I don't think there's anywhere else in Britain that's got two universities, neither of which are in crisis, financial crisis at the moment.
Yes.
Because even Manchester Met is, and
because
Manchester is such a popular place for people to go and study, if they can't go into the highly selective Manchester University, they're going to Manchester Met. Manchester Met's like one of the only places left in the country that has something like a cultural studies department, actually. So for that reason, basically. But the media cultural studies program is still basically a cultural studies program. Like people like me used to teach on. And that have all closed down nearly everywhere else. And that does, it says something about the kind of specificity of the place. But also the area does have, it has a huge amount of kind of downwardly mobile graduates paying too much rent because, you know, people, a lot, because also loads of people move up there from London, from the south, to go to university, and they don't move back because they don't want to pay London rent.
Yeah.
So, but that just makes it typical of a set of processes, which is the important point you're pointing to. It's not the specificity of Manchester, it's really, it's the fact that it's embodying a set of processes which are really happening all over the place. I mean, exactly what I've just described is happening all over southern England. And that's why, where the so-called blue belt is being worn away, you know, these places like, you know, from Chingford to Hastings, that were once Tory strongholds. And now they've gone, a lot of them have gone Labour or came very close to going Labour and look like they could go Green next because of the same processes.
Yes, because people are being pushed out from London. They're commuting to London but living further out in the south in Hastings or spilling over from Brighton in Worthing and these places. Absolutely, that's happening. But it's an important point to make here, at the risk of us getting a little bit into Labour criminology, you see, is that you could see in a constituency like that, or one might look at it, what a political strategist might look at it and say, how do we build a block, an alliance then between these kind of precarious graduates and students, the minority ethnic community that is there, and the precarious working class, white or brown, whatever they might be, that are all suffering from cost of living and from housing. Now, that would be not very dissimilar to the proposition of the original Labour Together report about how Labour could come back from defeat by building a kind of that broad-based coalition, which is the first iteration of Labour Together, when it appeared to be, it was John Quaddus and other people. It was sort of soft left of the party, thinking kind of openly about how to respond.
Dude, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. It's also the proposition in James Schneider's little book, Our Block. James Schneider, speechwriter for Corbyn, wasn't in your party for a bit.
Yes.
It's basically the same proposition.
Yeah.
And Labour Together, this sort of think tank, stroke lobby group, organisation, which is now in the news because Cabinet Minister Josh Simon, Starmerite Wunderkind, Josh Simon has been predictably forced to resign because it's turned out that when he was director of Labour Together, they were engaged in shenanigans, trying to discredit journalists who were investigating Labour Together. And, you know, it was a keynote in the Mandelsonite, McSweeneyite network, which is now unraveling before everybody's eyes. But yeah, exactly. Well, this is the thing. I mean, it's a really good point because so much has been made in the recent coverage of Labour Together about basically how dishonest it was, like how it was this front for this secret plot to take over the Labour Party and lie to all the Labour members. But a point that doesn't get made in most of that coverage is the actual political point that the starting point of that story is Labour Together commissioning all this research saying, Labour, what would Labour have to do to win? And the answer was, exactly what Alan just said. These people like McSweeney, allied to the hard right of the Labour Party, correctly drew the conclusion that a Labour Party which was going to do that could not be one in which they exercise complete control over the Badger's networks. It just wouldn't. Why would you have a Labour Party that was building the coalition you just described, led by these people whose like entire career has been based on attacking the left? And that's partly why they did what they did. That's why they had Starmer pretend that's what he was going to do, and then then expel everybody who would have actually been able to do it. Yeah, that's an inactive political project. So I mean, you're completely right about that, and it is really sort of extraordinary.
Yeah, they abandoned that strategy. So, and another party is now benefiting from trying to do something similar. But obviously we have, but in thinking about that strategy, because that strategy also means building that alliance between kind of the young precariat and the working class, And obviously the spoiler there is that, you know, the politics of division, as it's now often called, in the shape of reform, which is clearly about breaking up that coalition by emphasizing specifically the white working class. And so there's a lot, another podcast when we talk about why Labour has fetishized that conception of white working class and its fantasy of it, yeah. But it seems to me that it certainly has played into supporting that division of the white working class, both before and after, division between white working class and everybody else who's working class and precarious graduates and students and so forth. But that's a, to go back to where we started, that's also a reason for caution here, because reform did get like just under 28.7% of the vote or something, yeah. Reform did pretty well, actually, yeah. And it does suggest that they have some ability, even with, we'll get to this in a minute, even with the worst candidate you could possibly have, they did quite well. And they've clearly got room there. And Labour is, of course, what Labour is doing is facilitating Reform's rise by not facilitating the attempt to win over the old post-industrial, what thinks of itself as the legacy of the industrial working class in Manchester, into a larger coalition. But again, that's why it's interesting that, you know, where that Spencer wins by talking about cost of living, which from what I could tell, the Reform candidate didn't really talk about that very much.
No, well, he didn't, no. Well, you're right. I mean, I think part of what's going on is there's an implicit generational politics. I mean, the generational divide in British politics is now extraordinary. I mean, the Greens are the most, the Greens were the most popular party with people under 30, I think, in the 2024 election. But I think some people are citing polls recently saying they're the most popular party with anyone of working age now. If you take out that they've got that they're leading literally among people under 65, which is probably true. And implicitly, the Labour right strategy has been based on the idea that, well, it's better just to court retired voters because historically they vote, they're much more likely to turn out to vote. And there's more of them, they're more important as swing voters in marginal constituencies than young voters who tend to be crowded into urban areas or just to vote at all. So that has been their strategy. And that's also Reform. I mean, Reform, you know, If you look at the polls, for all the talk of young men being radicalized by Andrew Tate and whatever, like the support, even among young men, the support of Reform is negligible compared to its support amongst the over 60 following. And so I think there is an implicit kind of generational thing there as well, which, you know, was always going to be risky for them in Manchester, because the folk memory of Northern socialism is strong with older people in the North, in the way it's not part of the fake memory of people, of older people in the South, frankly. So that was always going to limit their appeal in some of those places. And it's going to limit it even more. You know, one thing I'll say now in relation to that, actually, Reform are not going to clean up as they're hoping to in South Wales and the North East if they keep recruiting all these Tory ministers.
Actually, no, exactly. Absolutely.
They're not going to. Those people won't vote. If those people become convinced this is just a Tory party, they won't vote for them. But I think, yeah, let's talk about the candidates, because as you say, it was this candidate. The candidates were kind of extraordinary. I mean, a friend of the show, Matthew Goodwin, the reformatory. Matthew Goodwin, not a friend of the show, but somebody who Alex Williams and I wrote an article about for Political Quarterly.
Highly recommended.
A year or so ago. He's just kind of unbelievable what a poor candidate he is. He's so lacking in charisma. He comes across as, you know, I mean, he does come. I'm always kind of joking. It's a standard joke I have about people that they come across like they're being played by Steve Coogan. But he comes across like he's being played by Chris Morris. He comes across like if Chris Morris, like British satirist Chris Morris, told to play an angry, a humourless right wing fanatic.
Yeah,
he's just hideous. Whereas, I mean, Hannah Spencer, when she was first announced as a candidate, she seemed too good to be true. You know, she's this Mancunian, you know, Mancunian plumber. We're living in a time in history when women plumbers are still really unusual, and when you know, self uh, self-employed sole traders that were all supposed to drive around in white vans voting for reform. And, she's got kind of long blonde hair. So she could easily pass for kind of Aryan right winger until she starts talking. And then she comes across as this very articulate kind of left populist who nonetheless makes quite a lot of that. She didn't go to university, but sounds more intelligent than most of the politicians who did. So, I mean, I did have friends who kind of know the scene up there warning me this all might blow up in their face. You know, what I was told privately was, well, actually, she's married to a really senior, a senior kind of research chemist at some pharma company or something. And I think it was AstraZeneca. And she actually lives in a really gentrified kind of posh bit of Manchester. And she's actually a heat pump engineer. She's not really an ordinary plumber. So this is what I was being told. But I don't know anything about it. This is all anecdotal stuff and hearsay to me. And none of that seems to have happened. None of that does seem to have come out in the wash in any bad way.
That stuff was on social media, attempts to kind of undermine her story in that way. I think it is the case that she was married to an AstraZeneca person. She does, I think they do between them own two houses, one of which they're doing up because she's not just a plumber, she's also a plasterer.
Yeah,
and a heating engineer, a heating pump engineer is also a plumber.
That was my initial response was like, that is a plumber.
Yeah.
This kind of plumber.
But this is part of what makes her so interesting, right? In terms of, attempts to understand, as it were, people's class location in relationship to their politics. Yeah. When, what you've got there is kind of like, research chemist. Where does that belong in our class hierarchy? Yeah. Tradesperson. Married, okay. I mean, there's complications there. Housing complicates these things all over. Yeah, so there's no these compared to, of course, the reform candidate, lifelong university professional, now media celebrity. Also divorced, now dating somebody from the Tatler magazine, right? Okay, so there's something. It seems to me you could sort of go a long way with this in terms of lots of dynamics, the kind of the influence of celebrity culture, media as a route into politics that Goodburn actually represents much more than he represents anything to do with kind of class background, class context. Yeah, this is a person who's obviously clearly always wanted to be in the media limelight and has found a route to do so. Is very importantly, as you said, utterly humorless, which is really deathly in the contemporary media environment. If you cannot look like you can take a joke or give a joke, that hurts really badly. As opposed to Hannah Spencer, and apart from Hannah Spencer, as you say, she's 30 something, so she's quite young compared to most MPs. Yes. And also in terms of the kind of iconography of women MPs over the last 25, 30 years, which has been quite sort of stylized in many respects, how people are forced to present themselves, the kind of business suit, the kind of the muted colours and so forth. I mean, I'm not a great reader of fashion, but she seems very fashionable to me and very well dressed in kind of like, and not in a kind of a way that you would either call business formal or kind of casual, but just like,
not even business casual. I mean, to me,
she's very well dressed. It's really what
it looks like, a normal person to me.
I think a very stylish person, I would say, but I think that's kind of interesting because that's what I'm getting at is the way that breaks from the kind of, I think British political culture in the court of Westminster has a very clear idea of what an MP is supposed to look like. The kind of suit they wear when they don't have a suit, how they should look. Part of Blair's innovation back in the 90s was to kind of like take off his tie, right? That was a thing.
Yeah. Oh, we've frozen.
People talked about as a new young generation. So what I'm getting at is the way in which I think sort of stylistically, appearance-wise, the kind of politician that Spencer is coming across as represents a generational shift that those brought up in the New Labour years simply are unable to recognise.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that's definitely true. Yeah, I mean, she comes across, I mean, very, very definitely as not a member of the professional political class.
Exactly. But yeah. some of the Labour people were offended by it, right? I don't know if you heard. So Bridget Phillipson, cabinet minister, she was on the news, wheeled out for the newspapers, the news in the morning after, and she said something like, she thought that Hannah Spencer's speech was, it was like my speech when I was elected in Swindon, And then David Blunkett said he'd heard the speech and didn't understand why she wasn't in the Labour Party. And part of what got me was, on the one hand, they seemed offended, which is a very bad look if you want people to be on your side. Secondly, what do you mean she'd be in the Labour Party? You would have expelled her. I mean, that's just not in question. Yeah. But thirdly, it's like their absolute inability to recognise where how they are perceived as well as where they belong culturally as a kind of party from 20 years ago, compared to a party that looks like it understands social media, looks like it can have fun on its campaign, looks kind of cool, you know, like you said, she looks like a normal person. Yeah, she looks like someone you might know. From other than like know in your personal life rather than know because you unfortunately study politics for a living.
I mean, also, I think we have to take seriously the content of what was said.
Totally.
I'm going to do another episode soon about the follow-up to the one about Zora, and I'm going to do another short lecture thing about vibes theory, because I think you know, we've all got a kind of theoretical investment to some extent in stressing how important like style is and mood and atmosphere. But I sort of think, I think none of that is really true. Like, we don't really have any evidence that any of that is really true, given that we don't have any examples in British politics from the past few decades of somebody just putting forward a simple economic populist, you know, class forward leftist message. And somehow not landing because their vibe or their style was wrong. I mean, we don't really have any evidence that anyone can say this stuff and it come across as really appealing to people, because so far, I mean, what are the examples? Like Jeremy Corbyn's, that wasn't Corbyn's content. Like the Corbyn's content wasn't, you know, basic left populism. It was a kind of, you know, annoying kind of moralism a lot of the time.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's true of Zach, and it's true of her. And I sort of think everybody says what great performers they are, and I think, I'm not saying they're not, but I also sort of think it's not that hard. I think it's not that complicated. There is something complicated going on in terms of being the kind of person who can do that. Maybe I shouldn't go on too much about this because I'm going to end up doing a whole episode about it. But there was always this, because I remember when Ed was leader, I don't know if he still remembers, but I know that after he was leader, and while Corbynism was at its peak, Ed Miliband told me that he remembered me saying, "Oh, Ed should go in a much more left populist direction, and it would work." And he's saying, "I wish I'd listened to you." but there was always a question about whether Ed could really carry that off, or whether it was never going to really be authentic. That this guy with the best bill in the world had grown up in Camden and gone to Oxford and then worked in politics all his life, could convincingly like express a kind of left populist message. I mean, in a way that might be Jeremy's problem. I mean, Jeremy's lived in Islington since the 1960s and went to a minor private school. So maybe he can't really do it. I don't know.
In sort of rhetoric world, we would talk about, it's not about, I mean, I don't like the kind of, oh, it's all vibes, it's all style, it's all narrative, but it's about the unification of your kind of policy rational claim with the character that communicates that with the kind of emotional feeling. It's about the combination of these things. Not just because you're trying to persuade people or fool them, because you're also trying to embody the kind of idea of the politics that people can more fully connect to it. And that's part of what I'm trying to get at, is the way in which it seems to me, you know, Labour presented itself as in the Blair years, you know, we are, it was a lot of rhetoric about we are a young country, and Blair was able to sort of embody that as, you know, a new figure. I'm a dad, but I actually like my kids. You know, I will play football with them, and I will, you know, and I don't mind people being from different backgrounds and having different sexualities, but I also want to be successful in life. That sort of embodiment of that, and I think Labour and a lot of politicos just don't get how that is not what Labour remotely does right now. Doesn't understand it. Doesn't do that now. The Josh Simons of this world, whereas the Greens do. I mean, I'm going to show you another bit of Hannah Spencer's speech. Right, she says, "I was elected because people in this constituency want change." Well, everyone says that. Yeah. But then she says, "We're sick of being told that there is no alternative." So there's a phrase for you, right? So actually here, change doesn't just mean change. It's connected to the fact that we can do things differently. We were told there is no alternative, that we should shut up and accept it as household costs spiral and wages fail to keep pace. That things which used to be possible, things that were normal not that long ago, free higher education, reliable and affordable buses, beaches you could safely swim at, being able to get a dentist appointment when you need one, are now too much to ask. People of Gorton Denton know it's not good enough, and today we've demanded more. And I think that's what strikes me is that actually the pitch here is we want normal back.
Yeah.
Not we're weird. We are actually the people who are in tune with the times and in tune with what people want. And I think that's the bit that's been sort of missed, that resonated with at least part of the constituency that Labour's not able to get, when it's like, but why isn't she in the Labour Party? Because you, as far as anyone can tell, you do not stand for that normal.
Well, I agree with all that. I agree with all that. I mean, I think there's a subtext which nobody's saying on either side of that, which is something I've talked about before, and we talked about in the pre-revolutionary Britain episode.
Yeah.
Which is the question of what is being implied about how far you're willing to go,
yeah,
in order to get there, in order to achieve those objectives. And you know, I mean, I thought it's a great, I mean, she has a great slogan, like, yeah, everyone deserves a nice life.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, the question is, what are you going to do to get it? Like, because my position is the only plausible, even social democratic politics now, is one that effectively says, well, if we have to occupy the city with the army and institute worker soviets to get people a nice life, that's what we'll do. We'll do whatever it takes, basically. And everybody knows that's not the case with Labour. Everybody knows that there's a limit. There are severe limits to how far Starmer or probably even Edmund Miliband Ramsay and Rainey will go to get everyone a nice life.
Yes.
If the obstacles being presented by powerful agencies to get everyone a nice life are too hard, they'll make it their job to explain to everyone why they can't have one yet. Whereas I believed, hearing Hannah Spencer's speech, that she'll do whatever it takes. She'll vote for whatever it takes to get everyone a nice life. So that is really,
No, it is important, because I think we've talked before, haven't we, about sort of why Labour don't seem to project leadership, that they want to kind of transform things. And don't misunderstand me here. I think reform also tries to project the idea that they would go however far they have to go to bring what they think would be a nice life. Yeah, yeah, they don't care about the Human Rights Act, or they don't care about completely redirecting your state effort away from economic activity to, you know, the physical force politics of deportation. So that there's something about both those, that there is this kind of like, we want to create what we think is a nice life, and we will do whatever it takes to get there. And people, of course, respond to that.
It's interesting that you can't imagine reform using that language, though.
No, they wouldn't use that language. It would be great. It's make Britain great again, isn't it? Yeah.
Which is interesting. And it is It's a risk that the right have won, actually. I mean, they've really run a risk aligning themselves with Trump, because they are forcing, you know, they're forcing just, you know, nice liberal Britain to ask itself, well, what does it want? If the only options on the table are two forms of revolution, well, they'll take the one for the nice life bank.
Yeah.
They'll take the one that doesn't mean children getting, you know, taken away and
taken
away by the army tanks. So I think all that is really significant. I suppose, I mean, the question that is like, where is all this going to go now? Like, what do we think is going to happen?
Well, the reaction to the results has been sort of predictable, but also kind of interesting, right? In the way that, it's been treated by some chunks of the press, as well as by Reform and by Labour, as a kind of terrible mistake. How could this not a mistake? As something that goes against the laws of nature. Yeah, that's really what's happened. They've sought to delegitimize the result, metaphorically and literally. And I think it's really important to observe that that's what they've done.
Yeah, the response from Labour, the response from Starmer in the statements he sent out to Labour members and to MPs, it was astonishing. It was basically saying, there's nothing to see here. We are the party of moderation. The Reform and Green are both extremists. The Greens sort of tricked people and got a load of Muslims to vote for them. It was sort of mad. Like, it just doesn't... I mean, it's not... And it wasn't... Again, that's not normal. I'm always saying this about Starmer. Normally, a party leader after a severe by-election setback, gives a speech about how they're now going to listen, how they recognise
that this is happening. Exactly. Yeah, they take their lumps. Fair dues, we've been given a kicking. We understand things have been, progress isn't as fast as people want. But yeah, let me reassure you, we are pushing things in the right direction. Actually, here are some good economic figures or whatever, you know, and we'll take seriously, etc. But they didn't do that. They do, and they haven't fully amplified, but they have allowed a kind of the vibe of so some immediate claims that there was some sort of dodgy voting going on from within the Muslim community and so forth. All of which kind of like, you know, well, we'll wait and see what there is about concrete kind of findings. But there clearly was a kind of sense that you know, either because people voted in relation to Gaza, that this was somehow illegitimate, or there was some kind of, you know, shenanigans. As if the Muslim community wouldn't like other people vote for the candidate most likely to beat reform, given that the candidate for reform was actively promoting their harm in his policy. I mean, it doesn't seem there's nothing mysterious in how this played out, whatever you think about everything else. So, but I think, but crucial was this way they called it sectarianism. This immediately came out, it was sectarianism. And I'm not quite sure, well, that was Goodwin's word. I'm not quite sure what he thinks he meant by that word, if he meant to say sort of like religious sects voting specifically.
Yeah, I think he meant communalism.
Is that what he meant? Yeah. But certainly, Labour kind of picked up on that a bit. And I think there was something in Labour about, I don't know, it's a way of saying it's not fair. It's not fair. You've appealed to people's sense of who they are or something like that. I don't know. But I think it's just kind of, again, that something inappropriate happened. And I did see Greens attacked for having leaflets that had Urdu on them. I mean, Tories have done that, Labour have done that forever, etc. Nothing was kind of unusual in that. But I think it's indicative of their inability to see that something is actually happening. I mean, this is generally the death knell of a party, isn't it? Or a movement, when it can't understand that things are happening. And so it reaches for, but no, it can't possibly have really happened. Something else must have gone on. That's your sort of like, that's stuck in the bunker, isn't it? Yeah, that's downfall kind of time.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. As opposed to seeing what actually happened and how you might respond to it, yeah.
Well, of course, you know, the historical phenomenon about which they've been trying to do that for the past 9 years is the 2017 election.
Yeah.
And what I think now, what's now absolutely clear is we're going to look back on the 2017 election as epochal. And as opening a new era in British politics, it's not the kind of blip they tried to make it be, because to a large extent, what's being expressed in the current political situation is just the two big competing sets of desires that were expressed in the 2017 election. There was the massive Tory bloc for Theresa May and Brexit, and there was the massive Labour bloc for a complete break with Thatcherism. And that's still what most people are trying to find a way of voting for.
Yeah, so I think that's really important. And I actually, in a way, that sort of fits with the sectarianism point, because, you know, Goodwin obviously meant some kind of religious ethnic sectarianism and as a typical, not really a rigorous concept. But it does seem to me that you can see that, yeah, that this was block voting, that there is, on the one hand, a large block that will vote for the left candidate and will kind of move around between parties, isn't party tied, but sees itself as the left candidate against the reform candidate. And there's clearly a large bloc now on the right that will vote for the right candidate, whoever that is. Yeah. Now there's lots of reasons why that's really dangerous for a political culture, I think. Yeah. Which we don't have to get into. But I can see that is what is going on, and that's going to harden. It's going to harden every time something awful happens. And you can see right now that Greens are already beginning to, and they will become more the target of a massive sectarian assault, right? That the attempt to delegitimize them, you know, that they are, I mean, this, the bit we didn't mention, of course, was part of Labour's attempt to defeat them in Gorton involved a leaflet saying that they want to, so the Greens have a policy of decriminalisation of drugs. Whether that's right or wrong, whatever, it's a perfectly intelligible policy position, yeah. But the Labour represented that literally on a leaflet as the Greens want to turn children's playgrounds into crack dens.
Yeah, I mean, it was, that's just crazy,
mad. okay, to think that that would work and wouldn't annoy everybody, but also totally pays into the sectarianism, right? And I think that, I think there's going to be a lot more of that from press and media. I mean, online, obviously, there's already tons of that. We had the kind of attempt to say Spencer isn't really a plumber, blah blah blah. They rigged it with something dubious in the Muslim community, and they want to do this, and we're getting it right now in terms of like NATO and Iran and stuff. They're going to get a lot of that. Now, my hunch is that will actually not harm them as much as people think it will harm them, because it will in part reaffirm their we're different, that we stand outside from the mainstream. I do think it will be challenging for Greens. I do think Greens, I don't want to sound pompous, but I think it's going to be an assault that Greens aren't used to.
I think that's true. And I've heard several sort of friends of ours and commentators saying this in the past couple of weeks, the past week, that Greens get ready for this intense media assault. Look, historically, I'm the person warning people of that. I remember warning friends who were working for the Corbyn leadership and McDonnell in 2016, saying, look, it's going to get much worse. And then saying to me, how could it possibly get any worse? And this is before the anti-Semitism stuff had started.
Yes.
And now I sort of think what you just said, that there's a good third of the most left-wing third of the electorate does not give a fuck like what any of the media say or the press say.
Yes.
They're totally cynical about them. If the Greens get themselves, to the point where basically all those people are voting for them, then they've made a historic breakthrough, which is going to break the electoral system completely. So it doesn't really matter. It only matters at the point where, that kind of toxifying of a political party, I would say, no, it's me getting into sort of hard sort of psephology. I'd say the evidence going back to at least to 92 is the problem is when the right wing press have managed to really toxify Labour in the views of some voters, then there's a certain kind of voter will be motivated to come out and vote Tory to stop them. And when they're not so toxified, those people usually stay home. That's why, New Labour always benefited from relatively low turnouts. And it's why the 92 election had a massive turnout, actually.
Yeah.
So, but the point is, the Greens are sort of, there's a kind of firewall called the Labour Party in between the Greens and the point where they're even bothered about those kind of voters. And, you'd have to get to a point where basically there's such a level of hysteria about the Greens that, the press and the media machine are trying to pressure sort of moderate Labour voters into possibly voting Tory if they have to prevent green chaos.
And I think that...
I'm not sure that the legacy media and their allies in the new media, kind of you studied so thoroughly, I'm just not sure they actually had the reach.
Yeah.
With even kind of centrist voters to be able to make that happen.
No, I think so. And I think that the thing is that, without overplaying this point, Corbyn stood down in after 2019, right?
Yeah.
So, in the past, I would have said that's not very long ago. But actually, we already live in quite a different social media culture from then. So things have changed. Secondly, Polanski and the Greens understand social media, which Corbyn never allowed. Corbyn's people didn't. People knew
it was like those things. Incredible. Jeremy couldn't do it. Jeremy would talk about the press and the media, on the news. He'd be interviewed on the BBC, but he was just angry at them. Like, he would never just say, "Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? They're my enemies." Like, he would get annoyed. He would be morally indignant.
Yes.
This is completely the wrong look. Zach's not going to do that. Zach's just going to say, of course they're saying that. We want to take their stuff away.
So I think they've got chances there. I mean, if I was making a pitch to the Greens, obviously I'm a general academic who's broadly neutral in my analyses of these things. I would firstly say they need more people than Zach. Now they've got a second one. They've got the other four MPs who you never see, which is a shame, but they were better. I would like to see more people coming out as kind of shadow cabinet-y types, or the people who would be in education or whatever as they come through. There's that. I also think I would bring a bit more eco into the eco-populism. I know there's a lot of reasons why that's complicated and the populism is part of what's promoting them, but actually I think there's a good set of things for them to be coming back and talking about kind of energy independence and stuff, yeah? And kind of energy bills. And they don't need to worry about reform saying, oh, gas is more green is more expensive, etc. Because as you say, they're not pitching for those votes. I think there's a bigger there. But here's my big pitch, and it's coming from that Spencer speech, right? My pitch then would be counter reform with make Britain normal again.
Yeah.
Right? Not great again, normal again. Continue to say you're the normal ones, right? Yeah. You want a nice life, a proper school, streets that aren't full of litter, and that hasn't all gone wrong because of the cultural Marxists and the Muslims. It's gone wrong because all the money's going elsewhere and being taken away. I think if they began to push that line, and that included like nice parks, places to walk your dogs. She's a dog walker, right? All that, a pleasant environment. You begin to bring that stuff in, right? And just stick on that kind of line. Keep with the kind of, why are you saying I'm weird? Because I think we should have a health service that functions. Why are you saying I'm weird? Because I don't think we should have prisons that are overflowing because they're full of people with drug problems that we could treat medically. Why are you saying that I'm weird? Because that's kind of what I would go for, that sort of stuff in that kind of Zach sort of Palancy.
I think that would be good. Although my feeling is that's not exactly the line that's they're going to attack them on. I mean, you can see what some of the senior Labour people really want to attack them on, and what I think they really believe, which is they're going to say this is false hope. That Zach Slope is make hope normal again, and they're going to say this is false hope. This isn't going to happen. This can't be done. And I think they are going to end up trying to sell them on a sort of. They'll end up trying to attack the Greens on the position that will. Yeah, lots of things have changed in the past 50 years. You can't have all the things we like and have back all the stuff you've lost. Like you can't have the dentist appointment and have the holidays. Have the holidays in there.
So that's, in a way, yes. If Labour do that, that's not a bad attack from Labour, I would say. I mean,
with a lot of intelligence.
It's regrettable, but that's where I would say, as well as bringing forward like other front benchy people, I do think that the Greens could do with kind of, maybe they're doing it. I mean, I shouldn't say that they're not doing it. I haven't thought of these things. I don't know everything about them. But I think the other side of it is that more, that is a sort of thinky tanky policy-ish kind of world where you begin to win over people, or at least look plausible to people who aren't necessarily your natural supporters, but understand that actually what you've got there is something that kind of potentially makes sense. And be able to defend that in that more intellectual kind of way. And I know people attack me are making politics academic in seminars, but part of what Labour failed to do was to build kind of connections with the places that could help support.
Well, I know they're doing all this. I mean,
they must be, yeah.
Midway's involved with this new think tank, this green thing tank.
And I
think they got...
And that will come through, yeah.
They got quite burned by Zach feeling like looking like he hadn't performed well on some, being pushed on some economic questions.
So he got to pick up on that. Yeah, but I think that's sort of I'm sort of rushing us towards the kind of ending point. Is that like if we go back to where we started with the by election, what does it mean? I mean, I don't think nothing about this makes me think that Greens are going to get 350 seats in a general election, right? Yeah, I just don't think that's going to happen. And if one speaks to them from a broadly non-aligned left, liberal left position, anti-reform, the problems still remain. How does that left bloc coordinate itself to prevent a minority reform government coming in? And also, how does it think about the possibility of some kind of coalition-y thing emerging or being forced on the parties through whatever the vagaries, the electoral system pushed through? That's why I think kind of one, from my point of view, one needs to, at the one hand, kind of, I kind of want to encourage everybody. I don't want to be like, you, not you. It's like, yeah, go on, do more of that. That's opening us up stuff. That sounds okay. Whether that's Labour people or Liberal people or Green people or your party people, if they ever get anywhere, or other people. I think we need to kind of keep doing that and keep pushing that, supporting that and hoping that people are cultivating the sort of thicker policy specs and analysis, as well as capitalizing on the fact that they are the next generation.
Well, I mean, I agree with all that, but I think if you think about what that actually means, like tactically,
yeah,
in the context of the actual situation we're in right now, I can't see how achieving that outcome doesn't necessarily mean between 100 and 200 Labour MPs being replaced by Greens. I don't see how we get to that outcome without passing through that route at this point, because 400 strong parliamentary Labour Party, like half of which was handpicked by Morgan McSweeney, like, just, you know, that is a major obstacle to the realisation of any kind of progressive agenda, whoever is leader of the Labour Party. And I think now, and I think we, one of the things we see manifest in the Gordon and Denton outcome is a situation in which, you know, as is often said by, you know, political scientists, you know, the electorate aren't stupid. You know, they're not as stupid as a lot of people want to credit them with being, or as unimaginative. And I just think there's a huge constituency out now. Like, why would they? What, the Greens are going to be now plausible challengers.
No, I agree with that.
If there are only challenges in about 200 seats, in about 200 seats, which are nearly all held by Labour, in which there is no reason for those electorates to stick with Labour rather than the Greens. Even if Burnham becomes leader of the Labour Party this year, why not? Who cares? What do they care? I mean, it's like, I would compare it to the situation in Scotland. Loads of people who've got no interest in independence vote with the SNP. They don't care. They want the most progressive parliamentary bloc possible to push for a progressive agenda. And I think the same logic is going to drive a lot of people to vote Green, like whether or not they really want a Green government. A lot of people are going to quite intelligently say, "Yeah, I'd rather have a minority Labour government with a massive Green bloc than have a Labour government," especially after the experience of this one. So I just don't see how. So I mean, and what that means for the Labour left, which I'm still a member of, I think really does need serious thinking about, because it does really need serious thinking about.
But I suppose that also begs the question. I mean, we've talked about the response of Labour in terms of like the sort of what they've argued on media, and you talked about Starmer's sort of, what you were quoting earlier was his kind of nothing to see here thing, was his sort of letter to members, wasn't it? I think a lot of members of the Parliamentary Labour Party were not happy with that. I think some of them do fully understand that they are in a changed political culture. Some of them are younger, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's
that generation.
True.
And I also think that I don't believe that anybody now doesn't understand that Starmer is entirely ill-suited to the job that he's in.
That's right. I know. There's no question Starmer's going to go, I also don't believe either at Miliband or Andy Lorena. We'll be able to
do it. Yeah,
I don't think they will be able to, you know, stave off the Green surge. Like, certainly not with this Parliamentary Labour Party. I mean, you've got to remember that half of these are people who were handpicked by Morgan McSweeney precisely so that some local candidate who looked a lot like Anna Spencer couldn't stand. And that's not what I say. There's just no. I can't see a scenario. I can't, in which you get you're heading towards progressive outcomes, in which that block isn't wiped out, and I can't see a scenario now which isn't the Greens' job to do that.
You don't think there's somebody will sort of pop up and say, "Oh, no, I don't necessarily want this, right?" But and say to Labour MPs, "Look, stop attacking the Greens; it just helps them. We should attack reform. People like it."
I think that'll all happen, but I just don't think they'll ever. Those people.
I mean, no, I think they'll attack the Greens. You see, and cannibalise themselves even further. Yeah.
I think that's probably true, and I just think organically, spontaneously, that's what these people are going to tend to want to do, because they, as I keep saying, they've been handpicked by Morgan McSweeney. They're not very intelligent. They don't know much about politics, but they know that the people they were hired to not be were not the reform people, were the Green people.
Yeah,
they are just, you know, I don't think most of them are going to have the imagination to like be able to move beyond that position and do anything but attack.
Yeah.
I think that's. Right, but even if they did try to, I mean, we can see it. My MP, Stella Creasy in Walthamstow, is desperately trying to position herself as much more left-wing because she's very frightened she's going to lose her seat to the Greens, which she had after Gordon and Denton. I'd say she's probably going to, because the because you know the vote in 24 was for the Greens was much higher here than it was there.
Yeah.
So it's very, very likely. It's, but it's just no one believes it. No one's going to believe it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No one's going to believe. No, and people are going to think, well, why was I? I mean, people are now looking at the, you know, the shiny, exciting, you know, new Green Party, and people, why would I vote for a sort of shit imitation of that in a new Labour business suit? You know, why would I do that? Well, I could vote Green. So I think there is going to be, but I don't think. But what the really knotty strategic problem, like I say, is, well, what does that mean? Because I don't. I also think, of course, the idea that the Greens are going to completely replace Labour. Yeah, you know, I also think it's a fantasy. It's a fantasy some friends of ours are currently indulging in. I don't think it's true. I think unpicking the party from the trade unions would be like almost impossible, and the trade aren't going anywhere. I do think it's very likely that in the next parliament, after the next general election, Andy Burnham will be leading a parliamentary Labour Party of less than 100 MPs.
Okay.
I do think that's highly plausible.
Have you put that on Polymarket already? with your Bitcoin.
no comment. I think all that is highly plausible. And in terms of like what we should all be doing about it, I don't really know. I feel like there needs to be a very serious strategic conversation within the Labour left, actually, about how we respond to this under those circumstances. And I sort of think for anyone who isn't like sort of active within the Labour left and committed to and embedded in it, I can't really see why you wouldn't just join the Green Party now and work for. There's probably about 80 really good Labour MPs. I think you don't want them out of Parliament, and them being out of Parliament would end up having all kinds of negative consequences that you don't want to have to deal with in terms of the politics of the unions, the politics of the Labour Party, the Labour movement. So my kind of exhortation to sort of Green friends and comrades would be to take that very seriously. That there's a block of left Labour MPs who are allied to the left of the unions, they're allied to the Sharon Graham leadership, the Andrew Egan leadership in unison, and you really want that. You want that to remain in place. And if you end up wrecking those people's sort of positions, you're going to cause a lot of damage potentially to the left. But beyond that, I think why wouldn't the Greens just go for it now in terms of replacing Labour as widely as possible?
I could see why they would think that. I mean, I worry that that's them succumbing to, you know, what politicians succumb to, which is a kind of arrogance and overenthusiasm, which, you know, beginning to think of themselves as the one true vanguard. And that's generally doesn't work out very well. But it's impossible. Parties have to pursue their own interests in this particular system. Those of us who are kind of maybe, you know, not so party confined kind of can be going, okay, we got some big problems here. I mean, that's the thing which I'm not going to open up that now, but yeah, the structural policy problems of the UK economy and state are deep, of long making and huge, and will be very, very difficult to shift over the next 30 years. And it is going to take more than five.
There's no question.
Yeah.
There's no question that's true. But I think it's, the local elections now are going to be extraordinary, I think.
I think it's going to be wild. I mean, as you've heard me say before, it's going to be a huge asteroid is going to hit Labour. And there may be one or two who still haven't kind of quite realised what's happening, but they're going to be unable to avoid it. They can't denounce every single council election as shooting sectarians. It's, you know, and it will also give us a much clearer view of exactly how far reform can get. I mean, it feels to me like reform ceiling kind of is now around 28-30% max, but the concentration of that vote in certain areas, some of that's, we're not going to get all of that clear to us because not everywhere's electing. I think the London results will be extremely informative and possibly really distressing for Labour people as well. Because you'll know better than I, the shifting and moving around, there's been quite a lot of defections and different things going on within the different boroughs and Greens, and I think we might see some really significant transformations there. And it's just a matter of at what point does reality become unavoidable for parties. That's the thing, is politicians, in my experience, are always telling me that they know what normal people are like because they knock on doorsteps, and I have no idea because all I do is pay a mortgage and live in a street and have relatives and friends. But so I think that their delusion that they know what the world is like is about to be tested to its final and ultimate destruction.
I think so, yeah. And I think we are thinking of doing a live seminar, a few days after the local election results in May to discuss the results. So you can look forward to that, listeners. I'll get some kind of a link together.
It'll be more of our on-brand Labour Party Sovietology combined with the finest cultural studies semiotic analysis of candidates' appearances.
It will be that. It will be.
Yeah.
All right. I think we've covered this for today, though.
I think we have.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Alan. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, if you can support the project, it's always appreciated. There's links in the show notes. You can give it a good rating. You can tell people about it. You can say thank you. Or if you don't have energy or resources for any of that, thank you for listening anyway. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Bye-bye.